Well, hey, everyone. We're always excited when we can invite a friend back to the Boundless Show. You have probably seen him out and about in other spheres, but we were able to nab him for a quick chat about his latest book. I have got Jefferson Bethke on the line with me. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going?
It is going well. Those of you who are maybe not quite familiar with what he has got historically going on, Jeff is the author of, you may remember, the Jesus is Greater Than Religion book, as well as really the YouTube video, Spoken Word, what Jeff became known for. That, man, when did that first blow up, Jeff? How long ago now?
I think it was about maybe 3 years ago, I guess, now, looking back on it.
Okay. All right. So a little while ago, and since then, Jeff has lived a lot of life. He is now married with a little baby, not quite a baby anymore, and another one on the way, right?
Yeah, we did. First one, Kinsley, 18 months.
Okay.
And then we have another one on the way. We're about 5 months along.
Okay. Well, I just know that from stalking you on social media. So,
hey, it's not stalking though. That's what it's for, right?
That's how we keep up with people who live in Hawaii. So sorry, you have to bear
that
cross.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, someone's got to do it, right?
Exactly. So that's true. All right. Well, we're going to talk about your latest book that is out. It's called "It's Not What You Think: Why Christianity Is About So Much More Than Going to Heaven When You Die." So this is kind of a, this isn't just like a fluffy little topic that you're delving into here.
Yeah.
Wrestling with faith and all that's going on there. So I want, one of the questions that you pose in the book, which is kind of a big question, but I just want to launch into this, is basically, okay, if you're telling us that Christianity is not what we think, what are you actually saying that it is? Give us kind of the broad brush view of what you're trying to address here in this book.
Yeah, so the premise of the whole book is basically saying that, we don't realize how much we've crafted our version of Christianity after a lot of things that, really aren't the world of the scriptures, the context of the scriptures, so much as kind of just American postmodernism with a little bit of industrial revolution and all these different things. And we've kind of made that like our Christianity. And so really what the premise of the book is that, yeah, Christianity is not really what you think. It's bigger, it's deeper, it's more beautiful. And it really gives life that I think a lot of us are looking for. I think a lot of times we have a Christianity, or at least we think Christianity is kind of just about the time you start following Jesus and then you just kind of hang out until you die. But really, really about every moment of every day matters. And it did to the Jewish worldview that Jesus lived in as the rabbi, and really just kind of pulling from that kind of angle.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's so much harder, I feel, to grasp for those of us who live a first world existence where everything else is cluttering up our daily lives, and what is primary seems to have no longer become primary. And really, I think a lot of us do treat it. We're just kind of like, in fact, we started this conversation a few weeks back where we talked about, are you living out your faith like it is just a kind of a ticket to heaven in a sense? What does it look like for it to be so much more than that? So one of the things that you talk about, now you and your wife, Alyssa, really are busy living the life of young adults where you are, and obviously, very busy with what you have going on. But you have a lot of friends who are also young adults, and some of them single. One of the things that you talk about in the book is the art of the table. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, about its significant place in history and what's its place in today's specifically Christian community?
Totally. I mean, yeah, historically, it's a fascinating, even just sociological study, even if you don't bring Christianity into it, of just how the table really has been a place that has held a lot of society together. It's really people who really hold the table up in the sense of, rhythmic gatherings, of doing meals together, of staying at the table long, telling stories, laughing, crying, whatever it is, actually has a significant weight on trajectory of life and learning, we've even seen. But then also, obviously, add Scripture to that and Jesus to that. We see that that's a huge value of Jesus and of the Scriptures and of, the first century kind of Jewish worldview that we've lost, that, man, God. And then Paul doesn't just talk about it physically, which is so true, but even metaphorically. Like, I think it's even the imagery of, Jew and Gentile and every ethnicity, every, race, every different socioeconomic background really is invited to this table where we're all one, where we're all sitting down face-to-face, eye-to-eye. And it really represents reconciliation, which I even share a few stories in the book of that. But I think we need to get back to that. And like you said, specifically with young adults, we have really forsaken that. We really are just so kind of on the fly, don't take time to slow down, to really be with each other. I mean, we've kind of lost the sacredness of meals, which really, and table, physically and metaphorically. And I just wish we would get back to that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems to me we've also lost the importance, like you said, going back to a biblical construct of the importance of generations, and that, you know, what we would say in a construct now of mentoring, having older generations speaking to us, having them involved in our lives, helping you raise your babies and stuff like that. Where do you see, I mean, it seems like we're so gravitating like towards like, you know, single young adults are hanging out with other singles and we're career professional people. How can we even build that into our lives in a world that seems to be so just technology and social media driven?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be a priority for sure, because if you don't set it as a priority, then it'll just fall by the wayside. But I think you're right. I'm a firm believer that, you know, doing life with other people in a real intimate way, also of different age and demographics, because, you know, I think there's a level of peer to peer is great, but then there's also so much that can be learned, and it's actually a biblical model of, you know, someone who's walked through what you're walking through 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and kind of come out the other side. And so I think pursuing it and making it a priority is really what we have to get back to.
Yeah. Now, you actually, in the book, you construct kind of a present-day scenario using September 11th, kind of placing Jesus' teaching in light of that. Speaking of, this is so crazy, I was just talking to an intern not too long ago who was like, literally does not remember life without September 11th. And for me, just like yesterday, you know. But we actually have a generation that is kind of informing really their understanding of culture. And of course, war is totally going on all over the world right now.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about how you use this September 11th picture and place Jesus' teaching about the kingdom to come in light of that.
Yeah. That's a hard one for a couple minutes. But I guess, yeah, I would say, we don't wrestle with, and I think we've completely almost kind of muted out of scripture, you know, the real non-negotiable of being a Jesus follower, which is enemy love, which is what I call it in the book, or sacrificial love for your enemies. And that's literally coming from the mouth of Jesus, right? Turn the other cheek, love those who persecute you, bless those who persecute you, love your enemies. Like, this wasn't fortune cookie type stuff that he just wanted us to say, this is nice and cute. It actually, and that's what I say, I take those right phrases and I say, actually, in the world they were in, that was so explosive and dangerous, because that was very, like, they were an occupied country. They, you know, Roman imperialism was over them, and had conquered them. And so they were in a space where they felt like, you know, they wanted to fight back, or that they wanted to, you know, take their country back per se, or whatever it is. There's kind of all this different imagery. And so I just draw the parallel saying, I don't know what that looks like exactly, how we put that into practice, but we're so far on the other spectrum that I'm just asking, can we at least even address it? Can we have at least wrestle with the hard theological concept of enemy love? And I think we're not even there, and I'm just asking, can we just go there? And that's really what that part of the book is using. And then I use the September 11th analogy as just putting it in our perspective of, like, this is, like, imagine if the people that did September 11th actually ran our country, right? And then that's really kind of what it was like in the first century to be a Jewish person under Roman rule.
Yeah. So looking at that, that's interesting, because just this morning I was reading an article about kind of historically here in Colorado Springs, we're in a huge divide where our city is very culturally divided. It's very politically divided. There's a lot of, you know, you wouldn't think we seem so idyllic sitting here in the mountains, but but we've got a lot of very, very polarized opinions and policies and stuff. How would you apply that, you know, so maybe not such an extreme context, but someone like just living in their city and trying, I mean, how do you support the causes you want to support without getting so angry and bitter and freakishly, you know, divided and stuff?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think the analogy and the imagery I use in the book that I just talked about a second ago is really the extreme, but also that shows us the weight of how powerful the enemy love is. But in our context, I think you're right. That's more where it's going to play out in America, is really, how do we, like, because the thing with enemy love is it's not just because, like we, the reason we do that is because that's actually where victory happens. Like, the model of Jesus is upside down, in that him giving himself up and looking like he lost, right, being crucified looks like you lose, according to first century Romans, was actually the moment that he won. So I just say, what would that look like in our context, right? So, like, we have a ton of political tension and People yelling back and forth to the point of really polarizing, actually, and really demonizing of each other. And so what would it look like if we kind of, you know, are actually seen as people who kind of give ourselves up for the other side? I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what that means, but that's the beauty of it. I think we have to wrestle with that. I think, like, we know the concept. Now we have to flesh that out, sitting at the feet of Jesus and asking him what this looks like, and kind of coming to a fresh perspective. But that's what I think where it will definitely play out in our culture, like you said.
Sure. Well, and I think another place where we are, if we truly live this out, we are set apart, especially in the culture of busyness that we have, is in the whole concept of a Sabbath. You talk about that a little bit, as well. What does that look like to the modern day person who really feels like they're struggling just to either make ends meet or be involved in the things they're passionate about or have any kind of relationships that are meaningful? What's the value of Sabbath in that?
Yeah, I think it's really about ceasing. Like the world has a rhythm about it, and we don't like to change that rhythm, right? Like the world has a rhythm. There's days, there's nights, there's months and years, and the sun comes up and it goes down. Like there's a rhythm about the world, and we don't really have a say in changing that. The question is, are we going to submit to that? And I think one of those rhythms is the work-rest rhythm. Work is beautiful and amazing, and we are created as image bearers to do that, but the flip side of that coin is that to do that well, we have to be working from rest and working from being filled up. And that's why God put that commandment from the very beginning. I mean, obviously it's in Genesis, but then commandment, you know, when you get to the laws and the end of the Torah, of actually commanding them to do a Sabbath, because that's what made them look different. Israel looked different. And it was kind of like a marker that says, oh, their identity is not in their performance. Their identity is not in their work. Their identity is not in commodification of themselves or burnout, which, if you remember, they just came from that, right? So Pharaoh was the guy who was saying, make more bricks, make more bricks, make more bricks. You get no rest, you get no rest. And it really commodified them and totally kind of really tore down their humanness. And one of the first things God does is brings them out of slavery and then says, you're going to rest. And Walter Brueggemann, who's a famous theologian, even kind of says that the Sabbath commandment, which is the fourth one, kind of connects the first three, which are all about loving God, and then like the last ones, which are all about loving people. So he kind of says, like, it's to rest well is then how you're going to love God and love others well. And we really have to know what that means. And I think we need it more than ever right now.
Yeah. So let's kind of breaking this down into the practical and moving it into your own life. So you are a husband. You're now a dad. You are an author. You're a speaker. When you get up every morning, what does it look like for you to intentionally infuse the gospel into your daily life, into appointments, into your relationships, into your parenting?
Yeah, totally. So right now it's really tough because I'm on the road right now and stuff like that. But when we're home, we really have tried to really hard to fight for rhythms, whether that's just waking up. And even for me, like, I've had to even walk through this lately of, like, I always thought it was more spiritual to just make the Bible the first thing you read in the morning, you know, which it could be if that's what you want to do. But I just realized, especially with a baby now or a toddler now, that's just a real hard time for me to get in the Word unless I want to wake up at, like, 4 a.m. So it's really more about trying to find rhythms that naturally you can, you know, be in the scripture, be in those things. And so for me, it's more about just waking up, being with Alyssa and Kinsley. And then there's a ton of encouragement there too. We really are usually talking about stuff and really having deep talks in the morning that are really encouraging. And then, you know, maybe later in the day, lunchtime when Kinsley's napping, that's usually when me and Alyssa will kind of go off and, you know, get some journaling time or reading time or stuff of that nature. And then, yeah, the meals are a big deal to us. We really try to really always, you know, have meals at the table, no phones at the table, and stuff of that nature. And we've just seen small stuff like that actually does make a big difference, and that's what we try to just keep doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, this wouldn't be an interview with The Boundless Show without treading into relationships and all of that, specifically your marriage. So I want to know, for those of us who knew you single and now married, what would you say, looking back, you know, your honest fears going into marriage? Where did you really have to trust God to meet you there and give you confirmation that this was something you were going ahead into, you know, that he was in this? And then what has been kind of the reassurance on the back end, like what you didn't expect about marriage?
That's a tough one. I'd probably say my biggest fear, I actually don't know if I really had any going in. I know it sounds weird, but I was very just like stoked and happy and just wanted to get married, just because Alyssa was so amazing and I was looking forward to it. But I would say it was more on the back end, which is also the part of the reassurance of once you do get married and you are in such a close, intimate setting, then the vulnerability kind of has and starts to come out, where you start to see that person does see all that you are. They see all these parts of your heart that maybe you had kind of even forgot about yourself. They're kind of bringing it to the surface by the closeness of interaction. And so then those are always the fears of rejection or having to be vulnerable or stuff of that nature. And then I think the reassurance is the cool part, the man that Jesus meets us right in that, and that also elicits in such a model of that too. And we try to do that back and forth with each other of just, man, that's what marriage is it's having that ultimate vulnerability and transparency and the person saying, you know, hey, I'm not going anywhere, I'm still here. And that's when really love takes a really deep and profound meaning.
Yeah. And so in light of that, kind of following up on that as a dad, how are you looking towards, you know, whether that's a fear or something you're moving towards confidently, parenting Kinsley and baby number two to honor marriage and relationship and, you know, feeling like, you know, hopefully you won't have to be the dad that pulls out the shotgun and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But knowing that you're
really
into a culture that's very, you know, could be hostile to marriage and relationship.
Totally. Yeah. Honestly, I'm not too worried about it. I think, you know, all the kids that I see that I feel like are older and I'm like, man, I want our kids to be like those kids. It's just because the marriages are so awesome. And so I really think I'm not too worried about it. I think it really just comes down to making sure that me and Alyssa always stay constant with a sense of, you know, we can say stuff, but really how we love each other, how we model love for our kids will be the biggest profound impact on how they see future relationships for themselves. And if we can really show them that marriage is this real depth of joy and beauty and intimacy that you can't find anywhere else when it's doing it, you know, under God in His way, then I think that will speak for itself because joy is always a more powerful motivator. And so I'm really excited to do that, hopefully. I mean, it's a big challenge, but I think, yeah, I think that. And then also making sure that we, you know, we really want to rebel against us, you know, I mean, the big phrase for it is, you know, child-centered home, but basically just meaning that, you know, like showing them that, you know, me and Alyssa are under that covenant and we're in covenant and we're going to send our kids out, but that doesn't mean me and Alyssa are going to be no longer together, right? So that's the center of the relationship and then we parent from that. I think I see a lot of relationships or marriages where sometimes the kids get sent out of the home and then the parents have no idea what to do. And at our age, we're like, man, we see that. We're like, we want to make sure that we backtrack and make sure that we don't make the same mistakes.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's already forward thinking in that sense. So, well, very cool. Well, the book is It's Not What You Think, Why Christianity is About So Much More Than Going to Heaven When You Die. I've been talking to Jefferson Bethke. And Jeff, so great to hear from you again. We always love having you around here at The Boundless Show. And, you know, next time, well, actually, I've never actually been to Hawaii yet. So when I do go someday, I'll just pop by maybe for coffee or something with y'all.
That's right. You're always welcome. And yeah, thanks again for having me on. Let's not wait 3 years till the next time, I guess, right?
Absolutely.